Hello, I'm Laura Castleton, U.S. Head of Portfolio Construction and Strategy at Janus Henderson Investors. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
The economics of meat production are changing. That's thanks to rising temperatures and greater variability of weather and the supply of water. Cattle ranchers are on the front lines.
Cattle ranchers are left trying to make up for dry conditions.
The triple-digit temperatures are having a big impact on California's cattle industry. Farmers say the heat is killing their cows.
Farmers tell me they were caught off guard by this week's record-breaking temperatures. It's not only been a struggle for these cows, but this is bad for business.
Some breeds of cattle are better suited than others to hot and humid weather, but not necessarily ones that produce the kinds of beef consumers want to eat. So to keep breeds like Angus on the table, we need to think of ways to make them more resilient. Because when temperatures get hot, they don't feel like eating, which means they don't put on weight. Crossbreeding has been happening for years, but other options are coming of age, including gene editing technology, which could be used to cut and paste our way to cattle genetics that thrive in a warmer climate.
Come here, girl.
She already, I believe, weighs like 170 pounds.
Or might we embrace something born in a more clinical setting, out of a lab?
In each small plastic box, we have approximately 100 million cells. We need so many cells because in 1 kilogram of meat, you have 10 billion cells.
From cattle yards to the future of beef on our dinner plates, this is the second episode of the Wall Street Journal series, The Price of Climate.
The future of everything. A look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
I'm so sorry about the mud. So glad that it's this week and not last.
My name is Kelly Sullivan, and I am co-owner of Santa Rosa Ranch, Brangus, and Ultra Black Cattle.
We're a couple of hours outside Houston, Texas, walking the grounds of one of her properties. Even on this damp and gray afternoon, the land is beautiful. Rolling fields are dotted with pecan trees. Her family has been in the cattle business for more than 100 years.
I am the oldest of the grandchildren in my family, and my grandfather, probably as classic a cowboy as you could get.
The family business looks a lot different than it did back then. Advances in genetics means they're producing more beef with fewer resources. We drive to another part of the ranch to check out the herd.
And really, the number one rule of the cattle business is select your cattle for your environment. And that's what we've done. That's what the Brangus breed is well suited for. And essentially, the genetic makeup of a Brangus is 3/8 Brahman, 5/8 Angus.
This part of Texas has a humid subtropical climate, the type in which Brahman thrive. But Angus don't, and it's their marbled meat that consumers want.
Hey, mamas. So these cows are about 5 or 6 years old. They are some of our donor cows, essentially the genetic base of our operation. And we utilize a lot of reproductive technology in our operation. We use a lot of embryo transfer and in vitro fertilization, artificial insemination in our program. Those technologies have allowed us to expand.
She breeds for heat resistance, flavor, and for efficiency.
Some cattle can get very, very large and require a lot of caloric intake to maintain their body condition. That doesn't really mean a better cow or a better animal. So what we've done is moderate their frame size so that they can be as efficient and productive as possible with the resources that they have, because this is a business for us. It's not a hobby.
Sullivan is the country's largest breeder of Brangus and Ultra Black cattle. She's feeling confident about the work she's doing to make the ranch more resilient in the face of a changing climate. But I want to know what, if anything, she worries about.
Frankly, we're going to have 10 billion people on this earth by 2050, and they need to be fed. And so I really take to heart that I'm raising the food that feeds the world. So I would never turn my eye from any type of emerging technologies. Everything needs to be considered.
Gene editing technology is often described as a genetic word processor. It allows researchers to cut out unwanted genes and paste in ones they do want. Sullivan is following how it might be used in cattle, including experiments underway to create Angus better suited to hot weather.
You should always be on the forefront of what's happening. What I consider, though, is what they're trying to achieve is a tropically adapted Angus, which quite frankly, with the Brangus breed we're doing already and have been doing for decades.
As far as she can tell, her calves have the same traits scientists are trying to create.
See these babies over here? They have milk on their noses. I mean, it's just there's nothing better than a milk nose. We're here at the beginning of winter, so everybody has their winter coats on. Again, they're adapting. But in the springtime, they slick off, and they shine like silk.
A slick, short-haired coat means the body stays cooler in the summer.
This technology and the idea of it sounds just fascinating and very exciting. But we have to see, is it going to be any different than what we already have? From what I understand, maybe. I don't know. I don't want to be a doubting Thomas, but is it something that would cause me to do anything differently in our operation? No.
Geneticists agree. Crossbreeding is one way to create heat-tolerant cattle.
We've been doing crossbreeding for a long time. I mean, we are using Brahman, which is a heat-tolerant breed, to bring in some of that adaptability. Hi, my name is Raluca Mateescu. I am an associate professor of animal genetics and genomics at University of Florida. The problem is, through crossbreeding, we are bringing in a lot of other stuff. So, for example, the Brahman, their meat quality is not as great as the meat quality of Angus. You're bringing in a little bit of that.
She studies heat tolerance in cattle.
So we are trying to identify the genes responsible for thermotolerance so we can improve our livestock populations through genetic selection.
The University of Florida used crossbreeding to give heat tolerance to dairy cows, but she believes gene editing will be superior because it reduces the guesswork.
The gene editing is going to allow you to be very precise in terms of what genetic background you are bringing into a new breed.
There's the potential for off-target effects or unintended mutations to DNA that can happen during the gene editing process. Plus, we still don't fully understand the impact of the changes scientists want to make.
We do need to create those animals to see, to measure the impact, because even if we say, well, we know this gene has a role, we really do not know. We cannot know the impact of that particular mutation until we put it into an animal and we see what happens.
If it works, consumers and regulators will need to be convinced that this is a good idea. The government plans to review gene-edited animals the same way it does a drug. That means substantial safety testing. But gene-edited plants aren't regulated, and the different standards have some in the industry crying foul. Other countries, including China and Brazil, are thought to be much closer to allowing gene-edited meat to go to market.
It seems like Brazil is a natural place, natural marketplace, and a natural place for cattle to test that because of it is a tropical environment for production.
Ted Sonstegard is a scientist who discovered a gene for heat tolerance in the Cenepole breed, which thrives in hotter climates. The company he works for, Recombinetics, took cells from a red Angus and modified their DNA to make the hide slick, like the Cenepole. It led to the world's first gene-edited calf, called Ginzelli. Conceived by IVF and born by C-section, she lives on a ranch in Brazil. As we report this, it's summer there, and so far the company says she's healthy.
She already, I believe, weighs like 170 pounds. So. When she's a cow, she'll be around 1,100 to 1,200 pounds.
So does it mean the experiment worked?
She has what we expected, a one-base deletion, which allows her to respond differently to heat. So her hair is shorter than normal. Normal hair is usually 10 millimeters in length on an Angus calf. This one is about half of that. We still have to do some whole genome resequencing of her to make sure that we were very precise in the change that we made when we introduced the gene editors into the cells that were used for cloning her. Once we show that, we'll have enough evidence, plus some of her characteristics will be evaluated as far as her ability to adapt to heat.
Until the sequencing is done, there's no way to know whether scientists introduced any unintended changes to the calf's DNA during the gene editing process.
I think it's a big step forward, not only for our company, but also for the field, as far as showing that you can take a trait from an adapted animal and move it into a non-adapted genetic background and adapt that animal for a new environment. Especially in a place where climate change becomes increasingly important relative to animal production.
So what do others working in the field of genetics think about this research?
I think the work they are doing is very important.
Again, Raluca Matescu.
I do not believe it is a silver bullet. I don't think we have such a thing when it comes to thermotolerance, because thermotolerance is a complex trait, which means we have thousands of genes controlling the trait. We also have environmental influence. So I do believe that the sleek gene, which is the one that they used, has a major contribution to the trait. But no, I do not believe that's really the solution to the whole problem.
But genetics aren't the only path forward. Producing meat without raising animals is no longer the stuff of science fiction. Unlike questions around gene editing, the U.S. government has decided how to regulate lab-grown meat, and investment dollars are coming in from Bill Gates and companies including Cargill, the world's largest supplier of ground beef.
So let's put our lab coats on so that we can get in the lab.
Didier Tobia runs Aleph Farms, a food company based in Israel. It grows steaks from cells cultivated from cows that are still walking around.
We believe that for cell-cultured meat to be a real option in the market, it has to reproduce the texture and the experience of the conventional meat.
3D tissue engineering produces lab-grown steaks that have a similar structure to regular meat. Cells are taken out of a liquid nitrogen holding tank. Each tank holds a series of boxes with roughly 100 billion cells. To put that in perspective, it's enough to make about 22 pounds of meat. The cells are soaking in an experimental growth medium that mimics and looks like blood.
Basically, we need the same raw materials the cells capture from the blood in the animal. We're not using blood, we're using a growth medium which has no animal component in it. But we need the same amino acids, vitamins, minerals, lipids.
Unlike a ranch, the lab doesn't need to raise herds of cattle in order to maintain a steady supply of stem cells.
We can duplicate those cells in order to get almost an infinite amount of meat. So we don't have to, take repeat samples of cells from different cows in order to grow a very large quantity.
That texture you get when biting into a steak, the lab is recreating it with an edible scaffolding made from various materials like collagen.
What you can see here on the screen is actually what we see inside the microscope by the means of a camera. Those are muscle fibers, and here are isolated cells. This is muscle tissue in the making.
It takes 2 to 3 weeks to grow something the size of a piece of cheesesteak. For meat the thickness of a dinner steak, the company says they'll need a few more years of testing.
We can actually impact the way the meat grows, meaning we can have some control over the length, the thickness of the muscle fibers, for instance, which is important for the mouthfeel and the texture of the meat, meaning that basically it can cost the same to produce a simple steak or a filet mignon or Kobe meat.
But will people eat it? It could come down to supply and demand. Severe drought and growing demand for beef have already created supply problems.
Even last year, when China was buying up all of the prime beef, there was a severe shortage in the States. The cost of prime beef went up, and it just wasn't available. From a business owner standpoint, that is a concern for me because I have a restaurant, and all we do is beef. My name is Angie Marn. I'm the executive chef and owner of the Beatrice Inn in New York City.
It's a Manhattan restaurant known for its meat dishes, like a ribeye aged in whiskey for 160 days. She says preparing the perfect steak starts with sourcing the very best cut of meat.
It's really the quality of the beef, making sure it's prime, making sure that the steer itself comes from a really quality purveyor. And then also you can see here, like, the marbling. You know, this is actually a steer that was started on grass and then finished on corn.
It's beautiful. How do you go about choosing them?
Yeah. I think that when you're choosing a steak, you want to look for a really good fat to lean meat ratio. I always, especially with dry aged beef, I'm always looking for that really deep garnet dry aged beef. And then, of course, the smell. Well, you know, when we're looking at dry aged beef, which is something that's tremendously important, you get this deep umami notion to it. And it's also almost a bit blue cheesy, you know, but that's just, it's an indicator of how well aged it is.
Well,
shall we get cooking?
Yeah, let's get cooking.
All right.
First, she brings her steaks to room temperature. Then,
I always like to start in a super hot cast iron pan and then flip it every 30 to 45 seconds or so just to slowly build that crust, which is also called a Maillard reaction. And then finishing it in the oven, we're doing the same thing. We're still flipping it every minute or so just to continue that internal basting process. Once we're happy with the temperature, we're going to rest it in a warm place, and we're still going to continue to flip it every 2 minutes or so, just so as the juices start to distribute, they're still basting inside and the steak remains even.
All right, should we go taste one?
Yeah, let's go. I know, you're all flushed.
How would a diner at the Beatrice Inn respond to something like a steak grown in a vat of liquid?
I mean, they wouldn't have the chance to because it would never end up on my menu. You know, I am very much a traditionalist and a purist. We don't rush anything. You know, you can't rush a good thing, and that's real. And, you know, to be altering, you know, an animal's, you know, like, why would we do that? Why would we do that?
So what would it take for her to even consider serving lab-grown or gene-edited beef?
If there was beef that was presented to me and it could still have the same quality taste, have the same marbling, have the same effects, be able to withstand the same effects technically that I do with my dry aging techniques, such as our whiskey-aged beef or our lavender-aged beef, you know, if there's, I would love to try it, but I highly doubt that anything, whatever, you know, what's going to really replace the real thing? Nothing.
Careful, you say it on that show and I might be back here with something for you to try.
I welcome it.
Next episode, the Corn Belt is moving north due to warmer temperatures and advances in seed technology. Investors are betting on land they predict will soon support soy and corn crops, but climate changes also mean farmers have to deal with more plant disease, storms, and drought. We meet a farmer growing commodity corn in a remote region of Canada that's as far north as Juneau, Alaska. The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode of the Price of Climate series was also reported and produced by Emma Silikens and Anthony Green, with thanks to Amy Doxer-Marcus, Connell Jones, Jason Bellini, Matt McDonald, Hilka Shellman, and Anne Marcel Gabirano. Our technical director is Jacob Gorski. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong.
You know, is that...
Okay, I'm coming, Mom.
Okay, it was a very cute little calf sprinting across this field to its mom. I have to say, by the way, all eyes are on us.
They are. It's the best. It really is. It's such a peaceful way to live.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost-effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.